his enemies, of course, who only tried to make a plot. And he said, I cannot come down. I cannot come down. Why should the work cease whilst I leave it and come down to you? Now, this is very symbolic, this language. And in the same way, we also should say, I cannot come down when such a controversy takes place. And the enemy of souls tries us to draw us away from the very work that God has given to us. Just simply let's tell him, I cannot come down to you, I have no time. I have to build a wall. Or, in other words, I have to look to the crown. Let's read now a little bit further on page 655. Again and again, Satan had been defeated, and now, with deeper malice and cunning, he laid a still more subtle and dangerous snare for the servant of God. Sanballat and his companions hired men who professed to be the friends of Nehemiah to give him evil counsel as the word of the Lord. The chief one engaged in this iniquitous work was Shemaiah, a man previously held in good repute by Nehemiah. This man shut himself up in a chamber near the sanctuary as if fearing that his life was in danger. The temple was at this time protected by walls and gates, but the gates of the city were not yet set up. Professing great concern for Nehemiah's safety, Shemaiah advised him to seek shelter in the temple. Let us meet together in the house of God, within the temple, he proposed, and let us shut the doors of the temple. For they will come to slay thee, yea, in the night will they come to slay thee. That was quite subtle, because it seemed that this man had the best intentions for Nehemiah. So we must be prepared that also the king of the north will come with seemingly best intentions to draw us away from the very work that God has given us. Had Nehemiah followed this treacherous counsel, he would have sacrificed his faith in God, and in the eyes of the people he would have appeared cowardly and contemptible in view of the important work that he had undertaken and the confidence that he professed to have in the power of God. It would have been altogether inconsistent for him to hide as if in fear. The alarm would have spread among the people, each would have sought his own safety, and the city would have been left unprotected to fall a prey to its enemies. That one unwise move on the part of Nehemiah would have been a virtual surrender of all that had been gained. Nehemiah was not long in penetrating the true character and object of his counselor. I perceived that God had not sent him, he says, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me, for Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Therefore was he hired that I should be afraid and do so and sin, and that they might have matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me. The infamous counsel given by Shemaiah was seconded by more than one man of high reputation, who, while professing to be Nehemiah's friends, were secretly in league with his enemies. But it was of no avail that they laid their snare. Nehemiah's fearless answer was, should such a man as I flee? And who is there that, being as I am, would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go. So Satan was defeated and again and again. Why? Because Nehemiah was constantly, steadfastly, on with his mind on the purpose of building the wall, and he was not permitting himself to be distracted in any way. Notwithstanding the plots of enemies, open and secret, the work of building went steadily forward, and in less than 2 months from the time of Nehemiah's arrival in Jerusalem, the city was girded with its defenses, and the builders could walk upon the walls and look down upon their defeated and astonished foes. When all our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen that were about us saw these things, Nehemiah writes, they were much cast down and in their own eyes, for they perceived that this work was wrought of our God. Yet even this evidence of the Lord's controlling hand was not sufficient to restrain discontent, rebellion, and treachery among the Israelites. The nobles of Judah sent many letters unto Tobiah, and the letters of Tobiah came unto them. For there were many in Judah sworn unto him, because he was the son-in-law of Shechaniah. It's interesting. So there were letters, friendly letters, going between Tobiah and some of the Jews. And this, of course, was a very sad fact. Some who had been foremost in plotting mischief against the Jews now professed a desire to be on friendly terms with them. So there was a link between God's people and the enemies of God's people. And this link helped the enemies to come and desire friendly terms with them. The nobles of Judah, who had become entangled in idolatrous marriages and who had held traitorous correspondence with Tobiah and taken oath to serve him, now represented him as a man of ability and foresight, an alliance with whom would be greatly to the advantage of the Jews. At the same time, they betrayed to him Nehemiah's plans and movements. Thus, the work of God's people was laid open to the attacks of their enemies, and opportunity was given to misconstrue Nehemiah's words and acts, and to hinder his work. When the poor and oppressed had appealed to Nehemiah for redress of their wrongs, he had stood boldly in their defense, and had caused the wrongdoers to remove the reproach that rested on them. But the authority that he had exercised in behalf of his downtrodden countrymen, he did not now exercise in his own behalf. His efforts had been met by some with ingratitude and treachery, but he did not use his power to bring the traitors to punishment. Calmly and unselfishly, he went forward in the service for the people, never slacking his efforts or allowing his interests to grow less. Satan's assaults have ever been directed against those who have sought to advance the work and cause of God. Though often baffled, he often renews his attacks with fresh vigor, using means hitherto untried. But it is his secret working through those who avow themselves the friends of God's work that is most to be feared. Open opposition may be fierce and cruel, but it is fraught with far less peril to God's cause than is the secret enemy of those who, while professing to serve God, are at heart the servants of Satan. These have in their power to place every advantage in the hands of those who will use their knowledge to hinder the work of God and endure his servants. Every device that the prince of darkness can suggest will be employed to induce God's servants to form a confederacy with the agents of Satan. Repeated solicitations will come to call them from duty. But like Nehemiah, they should steadfastly reply, "I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down." God's workers may safely keep on with their work, letting their efforts refute the falsehood that malice may coin for their injury. Like the builders on the walls of Jerusalem, they must refuse to be diverted from their work by threats or mockery or falsehood. Not for one moment are they to relax their watchfulness or vigilance, for enemies are continually on their track. Ever they must make their prayer to God and set a watch against them day and night. As the time of the end draws near, Satan's temptations will be brought to bear with greater power upon God's workers. He will employ human agents to mock and revile those who build the wall. But should the builders come down to meet the attacks of their foes, this would but retard the work. They should endeavor to defeat the purposes of their adversaries, but they should not allow anything to call them from their work. Truth is stronger than error, and right will prevail over wrong. So we have seen that there are two powers in the world. In the end, the power of the king of the north and God's people, And the power of the king of the north is the power of force. And the power of God's people is the power of right. And here it says, and truth, of course. Truth is stronger than error, and right will prevail over wrong. So if we just continue to build on the walls, we can be sure that right will prevail over wrong. This is not always seen immediately. It may take a long, long time until this happens. Now, this is especially true when it goes to influence over other people, especially influence over children. You can be sure that in the long term, right will prevail over wrong. The influence of right is stronger in the end. Let's read on a little bit. Neither should they allow their enemies to gain their friendship and sympathy, and thus lure them from their post of duty. He who by any unguarded act exposes the cause of God to reproach or weakens the hands of his fellow workers brings upon his own character a stain not easily removed and places a serious obstacle in the way of his future usefulness. They that forsake the law praise the wicked. When those who are uniting with the world, yet claiming great purity, plead for union with those who have ever been the opposers of the cause of truth, we should fear and shun them as decidedly as did Nehemiah. Such counsel is prompted by the enemy of all good. It is the speech of time servers and should be resisted as resolutely today as then. Whatever influence would tend to unsettle the faith of God's people in his guiding power should be steadfastly withstood. In Nehemiah's firm devotion to the work of God and his equally firm reliance on God lay the reason of the failure of his enemies to draw him from their power. The soul that is indolent falls an easy prey to temptation. But in the life that has a noble aim, an absorbing purpose, evil finds little foothold. The faith of him who is constantly advancing does not weaken. For above, beneath, beyond, he recognizes infinite love, working out all things to accomplish his good purpose. God's true servants work with a determination that will not fail because the throne of grace is their constant dependence. God has provided divine assistance for all the emergencies to which our human resources are unequal. He gives the Holy Spirit to help in every strait, to strengthen our hope and assurance, to illuminate our minds and purify our hearts. He provides opportunities and opens channels of working. If his people are watching the indications of his providence and are ready to cooperate with him, they will see mighty results. Now, all this, what we read, really stresses the point that it is absolutely important to have an absorbing purpose. And this is to look on the heavenly crown, to do the work that the Lord has given us, and not permit ourselves to be distracted in any way, by no means, not by discouragement, nor by threat, nor by offering of friendship, nor by crying, nor by shouting, and so forth. We shall not be distracted. We must make a very firm door against the king of the north. Let's read this again, this important sentences. The soul that is indolent falls an easy prey to temptation. But in the life that has a noble aim, an absorbing purpose, evil finds little foothold. The faith of him who is constantly advancing does not weaken. For above, beneath, beyond, he recognizes infinite love, working out all things to accomplish his good purpose. Now, Nehemiah could have been easily discouraged, couldn't he, in all this difficulties in which he stood. But Nehemiah looked on the crown. Now, to look on the crown means also to understand that God is throning over all these difficulties, over all this confusion that exists. Let us now turn to some of the scriptures that make this point very clear. I open Ezekiel chapter 1 for the moment. And there we read, let's begin in verse 1. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, on the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Chebar, that the heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God. On the fifth day of the month, which was in the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity, the word of the Lord came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Chebar, and the hand of the Lord was upon him there. Then I looked, and behold, a whirlwind was coming out of the north, a great cloud with raging fire engulfing itself, and brightness was all around it, and radiant out of its midst like the color of amber, out of the midst of fire. Also from within came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man. Each one had four faces, and each one had four wings, and their legs were straight, and their soles of their feet were like the soles of calves' feet. They sparkled like the color of burnished bronze. They had the hands of a man under their wings in their four sides, and each of the four had faces and wings, and their wings touched one another. The creatures did not turn when they went, but each one went straight forward. As for the likeness of their faces, each had the face of a man. Each of the four had the face of a lion on the right side. Each of the four had the face of an ox on the left side, and each of the four had the face of an eagle. Thus were their faces. Their wings were stretched upwards. Two wings of each one touched one another, and two covered their bodies. And each one went straight forward. They went wherever the Spirit wanted to go, and they did not turn when they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of torches. Fire was going back and forth among the living creatures. The fire was bright out of the fire lightning, and the living creatures ran back and forth in appearance like a flash of lightning. Now as I looked at the living creatures, behold, a wheel was on the earth beside each living creature with its four faces. The appearance of each of the wheels and their works was like the color of beryl, and all four had the same likeness. The appearance of their works was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. Now that scenery that we just read here, would you try to draw it down one time? It's very difficult, isn't it? Very difficult. For example, try to draw down the wheel within a wheel. How would it look like? Let's try. There's a wheel, there's another wheel in this direction. And then there's a wheel in that direction. And then a wheel, let's say, in that direction. That's a wheel within a wheel, isn't it? A very confusing sight. Now, this thing, not only the wheels are so complicated, but everything. They are four creatures, and they move perfectly. That is the strange thing. Even though there's one wheel within another, the whole thing moves perfectly. Now, this, of course, is a vision of the throne of God. Isn't it? The whole chapter. You find the same description also in Ezekiel chapter 10, where it also talks of the throne of God. And there it says in verse 10, a similar thing. As for their appearance, all four looked alike, as it were a wheel in the middle of a wheel. Now, if we would construct such a car, it would never go. But this car moved perfectly wherever the Spirit wanted. Now, has this a message? Most certainly it has. The message is that we find ourselves in a confusion like the wheel within a wheel. We find ourselves in such a mess that we seem not to look out, like Nehemiah, hedged in with difficulties from all sides, from the light, from the right to the left, and there's disobedience here, disobedience there. There's attack here, there's attack there, there's coming short of God's ideal here and there, there's disappointment here and there. These kinds we experience and we seem to despair. We think the whole thing does not work properly. It does not move where it shall move. And this is the feeling we sometimes have. Isn't this so? I feel very much like this at times. Let's turn now to page 535 in Prophets and Kings. Every nation that has come upon the stage of action has been permitted to occupy its place on the earth that the fact might be determined whether it would fulfill the purposes of the Watcher and the Holy One. Prophecy has traced the rise and progress of the world's great empires, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. With each of these, as with the nations of less power, history has repeated itself. Each has had its period of test. Each has failed. Its glory faded. Its power departed. While nations have rejected God's principles, and in this rejection have wrought their own ruin, yet a divine, overruling purpose has manifestly been at work throughout the ages. It's interesting, while these nations have rejected God's principles, and in this rejection have wrought their own ruin, yet a divine, overruling purpose has manifestly been at work throughout the ages. So the history of nations is like a wheel within a wheel, isn't it? Think of the present history. Think of the powers that are, how they try to manage their ways. It is very confusing, isn't it, at times? And it seems to go nowhere, the whole chart. But it goes. In all this, God's purpose is manifestly fulfilled. So even though these kings and presidents and rulers are very stubborn, yet even through the stubbornness, God's purpose is fulfilled. View it this way. At the moment, there's one president who is very stubborn against another president, isn't this so? Saddam Hussein against Bush. They are very stubborn both. They want their way. And it seems that they really make a big mess because of their stubbornness. But in all this, God's purpose is wonderfully fulfilled. I can't tell you now how at the moment, because I'm not sitting on the throne. But the vision of this all gives me this assurance. Now, this is the very thing that Daniel saw when he was studying prophecy. He saw that God's work was at hand in the guiding of the nations. Remember this statement? Let's read this again, we leave a hand here in page 535 because we want to read it on, and turn for the moment to the return of the exiles, where we read this on page 553. Often had Daniel and his companions gone over these and similar prophecies, outlining God's purpose for his people. And now, as the rapid course of events betokened the mighty hand at work among the nations, Daniel gave special thought to the promises made to Israel. His faith in the prophetic word led him to enter into the experiences. But now it says, and now as the rapid course of events betokened the mighty hand of God at work among the nations, Daniel gave special thoughts of the promises made to Israel. So likewise, what has the dissatisfaction of the people in the east to do with the hand of God? We have seen it, haven't we? It was foreseen by God. The car is moving exactly in the right direction. It is moving. That's the wonderful news. Even though one wheel is within another wheel, there's a total confusion. And yet God's purpose is wonderfully fulfilled. And this we can see for our personal life as well. God is just throning over this confusion. Let's turn now again to page 535. While nations have rejected God's principles and in this rejection have wrought their own ruin, yet a divine overruling purpose has manifestly been at work throughout the ages. It was this that the prophet Ezekiel saw in the wonderful representation given him during his exile in the land of the Chaldeans, when before his astonished gaze were portrayed the symbols that revealed an overruling power that has to do with the affairs of earthly rulers. Upon the banks of the river Seba, Ezekiel beheld a whirlwind seeming to come from the north, a great cloud and a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof, as the color of amber, a number of wheels intersecting one another were moved by four living beings. High above all these was the likeness of a throne, as the appearance of a sapphire stone, and upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness of the appearance of a man above upon it. And there appeared in the cherubims the form of a man's hand under their wings. The wheels were so complicated in arrangement that at first sight they appeared to be in confusion, yet they moved in perfect harmony. Heavenly beings, sustained and guided by the hand beneath the wings of the cherubim, were impelling those wheels. Above them, upon the seraphim throne, was the Eternal One, and round about the throne was a rainbow, the emblem of divine mercy. As the wheel-like complications were under the guidance of the hand beneath the wings of the cherubim, so the complicated play of human events is under divine control. Amidst the strife and tumult of nations, he that sitteth above the cherubim still guides the affairs of this earth. Now it's God's very purpose that things are as they are. He has foreseen them, and his plan is absolutely in the move. Now, this becomes also very clear when we study the story of the stubborn king of Pharaoh. Now, he was not reacting at all as would be desirable when the demand came to him, "Let my people go." He did not react desirable, did he? Quite the opposite. He became very stubborn. But this very stubbornness was exactly according to the plan of God. And that does not mean that God had made him stubborn. It only means, of course, in a certain sense he had made him stubborn, that is, in the sense that his light had shone upon him, and his rejection of this light made him stubborn. But God would have wished for the king, of course, that he would not have been stubborn but saved. But the point is, even though he was stubborn as he was, this fulfilled God's purpose exactly. As the wheel-like complications were under the guidance of the hand beneath the wings of the cherubim, so the complicated play of human events is under divine control. Amidst the strife and tumult of nations, he that sitteth above the cherubim still guides the affairs of this earth. The history of nations speaks to us today. To every nation and to every individual, God has assigned a place in his great plan. Today, men and nations are being tested by the plummet in the hand of him who makes no mistake. All are by their own choice deciding their destiny, and God is overruling all for the accomplishment of his purpose. The prophecies which the great I Am has given in his word, uniting link after link in the chain of events from eternity in the past to eternity in the future, tell us where we are today in the procession of the ages and what may be expected in the time to come. All that prophecy has foretold as coming to pass under the present time has been traced in the pages of history, and we may be assured that all which is yet to come will be fulfilled in its order. Now, we are reading this because we are living in the time of prophetic fulfillment, because we see it before our very eyes, and this gives us the assurance that God's plan is fulfilled at present. Today, the signs of the times declare that we are standing on the threshold of great and solemn events. Everything in our world is in agitation. Before our eyes is fulfilled the Savior's prophecy of the events to precede his coming. Ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. Nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. Is this so? Certainly. The present is a time of overwhelming interest to all living. Rulers and statesmen, men who occupy positions of trust and authority, thinking men and women of all classes have their attention fixed upon the events taking place about us. Is this so? Certainly. When you go in the world, they tell you, boy, these are tremendous events that are taking place. Really, tremendous events. Everybody is fixing his attention on these events that are taking place about us. And they are of such historical value that nobody denies it. They are watching the relations that exist among the nations. They observe the interest that is taking possession of every earthly element. And they recognize that something great and decisive is to take place, that the world is on a verge of a stupendous crisis. Do the people realize this? Very certain. The Bible and the Bible only gives a correct view of these things. Here are revealed the great final scenes in the history of our world, events that already are casting their shadows before, the sound of their approach causing the earth to tremble and men's heart to fail them for fear. Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof, because they have transgressed the laws, changed the ordinance, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate. Alas for the day! For the day of the Lord is at hand, and as a destruction from the Almighty shall it come. The seed is rotten under their clods, the garners are laid desolate, the barns are broken down, for the corn is withered. How do the beasts groan? The herds of cattle are perplexed, because they have no pasture. Ye, the flocks of sheep are made desolate, the vine is dried up, and the fig tree languishes. The pomegranate tree, the palm tree also, and the apple tree, even all trees of the fields are withered, because joy is withered away from the sons of men. That is a text from Joel 1. I am pained in my heart. I cannot hold my peace, because thou hast heard, O my soul, the sound of the trumpet, the alarm of war. Destruction upon destruction is cried, for the whole land is spoiled. Alas, for the day is great, so that none is like it. It is even the time of Jacob's trouble, but he shall be saved out of it. O daughter of Zion, the Lord shall redeem thee from the hand of thine enemies. Now also many nations are gathered against thee that say, let her be defiled, and let our eye look upon Zion. But they know not the thoughts of the Lord, neither understand they his counsel. God will not fail his church in the hour of her greatest peril. He has promised deliverance. I will bring again the captivity of Jacob's tents. He has declared and have mercy on his dwelling places. Then will the purpose of God be fulfilled. The principles of his kingdom will be honored by all beneath the sun. I was beginning on page 535 and was reading to the end of the chapter. It's a chapter, The Unseen Watcher. It's a very interesting chapter, and this shows us exactly that we shall not be discouraged when we find ourselves in complicated situations like Nehemiah found himself on. All we have to do is to steadfast, without wavering, look on the crown of life and not be distracted from this look. Now, it is easy to look on the crown of life now, at the moment, but it is not so easy when we are hedged in by difficulties. But still we may, and we may rejoice in the fact that God's purpose is fulfilled. Never let a dark future cloud our mind. Never let discouragement permit ourselves to take position, because even though the wrong seems so strong, the devil is a conquered foe. Why should we not more praise Jesus? Why should we not look to the throne above the complicated running of the wheels and praise the work of God that is perfectly fulfilled at the present time in the nations? And as it is fulfilled in the nations, so it is fulfilled in our personal life as well. Now, you see, it's fairly easy to stand afar off and see all the turmoils and troubles in the East and say, well, fine, God's prophecy is fulfilled. Also the turmoil in the Near East. Do you call it Near East or Far East? Far East you call it here. We call it Near East from our point of view. Okay, anyway, the situation that is taking place there is fairly easy to see, and we can see, okay, God's purpose is fulfilled. But if he would be in the middle of this trouble spot, how would we feel then? We would just see a complicated wheel within a wheel. Now, that may be our personal situation for the moment. We may find ourselves just in such a situation, hedged in by difficulties. But then let us be carried above these difficulties and let's view them from another angle, like we view today the events that are taking place in the East and in the Far East. Let's view them from above. And when the devil wants to call us down, let us say, we cannot come down to you, we have no time. We have to look at the things from another angle now, and we have to build the wall. We have definitely to do a work, and let us do this work with all our heart and with all our mind and not be distracted in any way whatsoever. And this I wish for each one of us, so that we can finish building the wall which we have started. Now the time is almost over, and I'm really finished with the study, so do you mind if we close? It's a little bit early. 1 minute we still have. Do you have something, Ian? Each actor? Okay, Ian wanted me to read something from a worship book from Sister White, Conflict and Courage, page 371. Each actor in history stands in his lot and place for God's great work after his own plan will be carried out by men who have prepared themselves to fill positions for good or evil. In opposing to righteousness, men become instruments of unrighteousness, but they are not forced to take this course of action. They need to become instruments of unrighteousness. They need not become instruments of unrighteousness any more than kind needed to. Thank you. That shows that it would need to be so complicated. God doesn't force it, but even though it is, each one is standing in his place, exactly, and is fulfilling his place in God's plan. That means that God is never surprised by any difficult circumstance. Is he? Thank you very much. Another contribution? Men are all, in the same, in next paragraph? Men of all characters, righteous and unrighteous, will stand in their several positions in God's plan. With the character they have formed, they will act their part in the fulfillment of history. In a crisis, just at the right moment, they will stand in the places they have prepared themselves to fill. Believers and unbelievers will fall into line as witnesses to confirm truth that they themselves do not comprehend. All will cooperate in accomplishing the purpose of God, just as did Annas, Caiaphas, Pilate, and Herod. In putting Christ to death, the priests thought they were carrying out their own purposes, but unconsciously and unintentionally, they were fulfilling the purpose of God. Thank you very much. That's very good, the statement.